Today is Wednesday, January 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. As U.S.-NATO-Russia talks continue, a former U.S. official says he thinks Russia is planning to invade Ukraine.
I think we're very close to a military confrontation, a matter of weeks, really.
A former ambassador to Kazakhstan says discontent in that country has been building for years.
And this has been going on for quite a few years in the sense of a growing disconnect between those who govern and those who are governed.
Plus, North Korea says its latest missile launch test was a success. We'll have these stories and more next. NATO Chief Jens Stoltenberg on Wednesday said NATO allies have significant differences with Russia over its demands for new security rules in Europe, but are ready to meet Kremlin envoys again. After NATO officials met with Russian counterparts on Wednesday, Stoltenberg told journalists NATO might deploy additional troops to Eastern allies should Russia again use force against Ukraine. He warned there is a real risk for a new armed conflict in Europe, although he said NATO would do what it could to prevent that. Russian, European, and U.S. diplomats have held a series of meetings this week to try to de-escalate tensions over the buildup of Russian forces along its border with Ukraine. As AP correspondent Tim McGuire reports, there's widespread skepticism that Russian proposals for easing tensions are genuine.
Two former U.S. ambassadors, one to Poland, the other to NATO, say Russian President Vladimir Putin has amassed more than 100,000 troops along the border with Ukraine to intimidate the U.S. and NATO to back away from Eastern Europe and Ukraine. Ivo Dalder, once ambassador to NATO, says military action could come soon.
I think we're very close to a military confrontation, a matter of weeks, really.
Analyst Dan Fried, former ambassador to Poland, says Putin and his government are capable of manufacturing an incident to spark warfare.
But they're capable of this, of making the claim or staging it themselves.
U.S. negotiator Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman says Russia needs to stay at the table and return its troops to their barracks in order to de-escalate the situation. I'm Tim McGuire.
Kazakhstan officials say 164 people were killed in a week of protests. Officials say government buildings and institutions are back under state control after days of protests sparked by fuel price hikes suddenly turned violent. Former U.S. ambassador to Kazakhstan, George Kroll, tells me he's heard that Kazakhstan's largest city, Almaty, and the capital, Nur-Sultan, have stabilized and that Russian security forces have left. But other factors, such as what led up to the violence, are still unclear.
The collective security treaty organization forces that had been brought in to guard certain government facilities are returning. They're leaving. And that the President Tokayev spoke virtually to the parliament. They've confirmed his pick for the prime minister. He's unveiled a new government and even spoke in his speech that now is the time for building a new Kazakhstan. And we shall see what that will mean as he's made a lot of changes in the people in the various government offices, particularly in the presidential administration, the security services, and the others. From what I understand on the ground, to the extent that I know, there is no more violence I don't know if the airports are open. I think the airport in Nur-Sultan, I understand, is open for international flights for some of them. Whether or not Almaty is open for all flights, I do not know. It seems to be that the situation is probably, quote unquote, normalizing.
I've read that the security officers in Nur-Sultan are going door to door trying to root out what the city law enforcement folks there are calling violators of public order. You know anything about that?
Other than that's what I've heard, but I heard that was going on in perhaps Almaty, where the violence took place, and that there were law enforcement officers of whatever stripe that may be going door to door for that purposes of rooting out people that may have been either involved or that they think might be planning to be involved or had been planning to be involved in violent acts. But what that means and who those people may be and what constitutes planning or being involved in a violent act, I don't know. I don't know what their criteria is.
Well, you've spent a lot of time there. You can tell us, has this been building for a long time? What is going on with the outrage of the people? And also, as a follow-up question, How could this have gone on for so long with the bloody protests and the killings?
I think in some respects you have to separate out the popular, or at least among many, many people, their grievances about the economic and social economic support that they're getting and attention from the government has been building over time because of, and it's not just prices, but a growing sense of stagnation, and that, you know, the wealthy get wealthier, or they're not suffering as much as the common person who is facing higher prices and difficulty getting services, health services. You have the COVID pandemic that has concerned a lot of people as to how they're being taken care of by the state. And this has been going on for quite a few years in the sense of a growing disconnect between those who govern and those who are governed. The government, Kazakhstan, has been rather aware of it and tries to deal with it by lowering prices and promising there'll be commissions and changes, but then people see nothing really changes. And so that just exacerbates it. And I think that was what we were seeing in the first instance of, you know, peaceful demonstrations and calling for change and the like.
But then it changed and it got out of hand. And for the president to have ordered shoot to kill orders, how do you square that?
Well, this gets into what we could call the second phase, and that's when the, you know, when the peaceful demonstrators, as it were went home. They weren't staying overnight or things of that nature. It seemed that on the evening of the 5th of January, what I've been hearing from people who had eyewitnesses and the like was that the police just disappeared from Almaty, at least. And I don't know what was all going on in these other cities, but there wasn't this violence in Western Kazakhstan. We didn't see anything or hear anything in Nur-Sultan, the capital. But in Almaty, where the people were reporting and calling their family members who live outside of Kazakhstan to say that the police had just disappeared, and then a mob appeared. They were basically a lot of, you know, young, burly men, who they were, where they came from, and they were very methodical in breaking into ATM machines and into public buildings and into police stations, and they went into the mayor's building and broke in, trashed it, and set it on fire, but they never stayed there, and there was no law enforcement that there to prevent them.
That was former U.S. Ambassador to Kazakhstan, George Kroll. He was speaking to me from his home in Newport, Rhode Island on Tuesday. In part two of our interview tomorrow, Kroll talks about Kazakhstan's strategic importance and why the people of that nation have been demanding reforms for so long. With tensions high over the prospect of a Russian invasion of Ukraine, analysts say Turkey has a pivotal role as the enforcer of an international convention governing naval access to the Black Sea. As Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, Ankara is aware any conflict will bring pressure from both Moscow and Turkey's NATO partners in its role as gatekeeper to the Black Sea.
NATO warships have been stepping up their presence in the Black Sea in support of Ukraine as Russia builds up its forces on the Ukrainian border. Access to the Black Sea is only through Istanbul's Bosphorus Strait, which is controlled by the 1936 Montreux Convention. The convention, administered by Turkey, restricts naval vessels from non-Black Sea countries to a maximum of 10,000 tons per ship and for only 21 days. Mithat Rende is a retired Turkish ambassador and an expert on maritime affairs.
If worse comes to worse and then Ukraine has to be protected or defended, there is a limit to what NATO can keep as naval forces and naval platforms in the Black Sea, according to the Montreux Convention.
The Montreux Convention is of historical importance for Turkey, as it restored Turkish sovereignty and control to the network of internal waterways linking the Black Sea to open seas. But some analysts warn that Turkey's role as Black Sea gatekeeper puts it in a difficult position with its NATO partners at times of high tensions. Mustafa Aydin is a professor of international relations at Kadir Has University.
During the Russian-Georgian War in 2008, the United States and other NATO allies tried to bring more ships into the region. And initially, Turkey did not allow the first request from the United States because it was violating the limits of the tonnage of the ships. Eventually, the U.S. Changed that request into another two small ships instead of one big ship, and that they were allowed.
But Turkey is also facing pressure from Russia. Last year, American warships' use of Istanbul's Bosphorus waterway to participate in NATO-Ukrainian naval exercises drew swift condemnation from Russian President Vladimir Putin. Observers predict Russian pressure will grow if NATO steps up its Black Sea naval presence. Hüseyin Barca heads the Turkish Foreign Policy Institute in Ankara.
Russia is also making pressure on Turkey not to get involved, whether as a NATO member or a good neighbor of Ukraine. And the Russians do not hide every opportunity to criticize Turkey and to not threaten, maybe, but to tell Turkey that Turkey should not make any wrong step.
Ankara is looking to this week's talks to defuse soaring tensions and hoping both sides will avert a further military build-up in the region. An escalation that could bring with it new problems for Turkey in its historical role as gatekeeper of the Black Sea. Doreen Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
U.S. President Joe Biden is pushing legislation to prevent states from imposing laws that limit access to the vote, arguing voting rights are a bedrock American value and need to be better protected. His Republican opponents want states to support more rigorous voter identification and ballot security measures to prevent voter fraud. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
U.S. President Joe Biden is throwing his weight behind politically divisive legislation that would allow more federal oversight over elections, saying the stakes are high in the aftermath of the 2020 presidential election. Speaking in Atlanta on Tuesday, he painted the two bills in stark terms.
Will we choose democracy over autocracy, light over shadows, justice over injustice? I know where I stand. I will not yield. I will not flinch. I will defend the right to vote, our democracy against all enemies, foreign and, yes, domestic. And the question is, where will the institution of the United States Senate stand?
In the past year, at least 19 states have passed laws restricting access to voting, according to New York University's Brennan Center for Justice. Biden wants to amend the landmark 1965 Voting Rights Act, arguing that the federal government should rein in states that try to discourage eligible voters by making voting inconvenient, difficult, or confusing. Biden made his argument in Georgia, one of the handful of states where former President Donald Trump claims voter fraud led to his loss in the 2020 presidential election. There's no evidence to back that claim. This debate is urgent, he said, after Trump's election fraud claims triggered a violent attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, as Trump supporters tried to force legislators to stop certifying Biden's win. But, says John Fortier of the American Enterprise Institute, this will be an uphill battle.
It's still a pretty broad-based set of changes that would apply everywhere nationally, that would overrule the states. And there's lots of enthusiasm on the Democratic side, partly because they believe in these issues generally, but partly also with January 6th and other things that are motivating them to think that these changes are what's needed. That being said, there is no support on the Republican side.
Members of Trump's party largely oppose the legislation. They argue that Republicans aren't seeking to block anyone's access to the polls, but rather to protect against voter fraud. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
It appears as if the majority leader is hell-bent to try to break the Senate. His argument is that somehow state legislatures across the country are busily at work trying to make it more difficult for people to vote. Of course, that's not happening anywhere in America.
Voting rights activists say they see clear evidence of discrimination in these new voting laws. Some key activists skipped Biden's speech, saying they wanted action from the president, not words. Rebecca Carruthers is vice president of the Fair Election Center.
What we're seeing within the United States is that we're being told that not everyone has the same right to vote, especially young people, especially those who are disabled, especially communities of color, Black people, Latinos, Latinx people, Asian, Native American, Indigenous people. They're being told that your right to vote doesn't matter as much, as well as those who have immigrated to our country and have become naturalized citizens.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has pledged to bring the legislation to the floor for a vote before next week. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
Some health experts say the Omicron surge may be headed for a rapid drop in COVID-19 cases in the U.S. and Britain. AP correspondent Jennifer King has that story.
The variant has proved so contagious that just a month and a half after the first cases were detected in the UK and the United States, it's running out of people to infect. Scientists say there are signs that Britain's wave of new daily coronavirus infections is dropping from a record peak and is about to do the same in the United States. Models from the University of Texas predict daily cases in the U.S. crested this week, while the University of Washington's model projects cases will peak by January 19th and then fall sharply, much like what happened in South Africa. Even with a drop-off, COVID deaths and pressure on hospitals will continue for weeks, and experts warn that much is still uncertain about the next phase of the pandemic. I'm Jennifer King.
You're listening to VOA News. Tennis star Novak Djokovic said on Wednesday an incorrect answer was made on his Australian entry documents, breaching the country's strict laws on reporting recent travel. Reuters correspondent Flora Bradley Watson reports.
Novak Djokovic admitted on Wednesday that an incorrect answer was made on his Australia entry forms. The world number one tennis star's visa to play in the Australian Open is still in doubt, as government officials now consider whether to deport him over the error. Giving false or misleading information is an offence carrying a maximum penalty of 12 months in prison and a fine of up to $4,730. It can also lead to the cancellation of the offender's visa. Djokovic said his travel declaration was filled in by his support team, who made an administrative mistake. The team member ticked the no box in response to whether he had travelled elsewhere in the 14 days before arriving in Australia. Questions arose about the Serbian star's movements when social media posts appeared to show him in Belgrade less than 2 weeks before he headed to Spain and then on to Australia. In a post on his Instagram account, he said, quote, "This was human error and certainly not deliberate. We are living in challenging times in a global pandemic, and sometimes these mistakes can occur." The player also apologizes in his statement for attending an interview and photo shoot on December the 18th, the day after he said he learned he had tested positive for COVID-19 for the second time. Djokovic was only released from Melbourne's immigration detention on Monday after being held there for several days. Officials had revoked his visa amid questions over his medical exemption for a requirement to be vaccinated against COVID-19. That decision was quashed by a judge on Monday, who called the cancellation of his visa unreasonable. The tennis star now faces the possibility of having his visa revoked for a second time, just days before he's due to defend his title at the Australian Open.
That was Flora Bradley Watson with Reuters. Russian President Vladimir Putin on Wednesday said Russia has 2 weeks to prepare for a fresh wave of coronavirus infections driven by the Omicron variant after the World Health Organization warned of a surge in Europe. Russia has lifted almost all restrictions aimed at limiting new cases despite a rising caseload and growing Omicron infections. In India, Bharat Biotech said Wednesday that a booster shot of its Covaxin COVID-19 vaccine administered 6 months after the last of two doses neutralized both the Omicron and Delta variants. The company said more than 90% of all individuals boosted with Covaxin showed neutralizing antibodies. In a high-stakes showdown in Parliament, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson on Wednesday expressed regret and apologized for a staff party held in the garden of his official residence. Johnson told members of Parliament he had attended the gathering in May 2020 at 10 Downing Street when Britons were banned from mingling in groups. Opposition members called on him to resign, but Johnson did not do so. North Korea claims its latest test of hypersonic missile was a success. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
The North State media says leader Kim Jong-un oversaw a successful flight test of a hypersonic missile he claimed would remarkably increase the country's war deterrent. The report comes a day after the militaries of South Korea and Japan said they detected South Korea firing a suspected ballistic missile into its eastern sea. The launch was North Korea's second test of a purported hypersonic missile in a week, as Kim continues a defiant push to expand his nuclear weapons capabilities. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
U.S. adults usually catch one or two common colds a year. They're usually a little more than an annoyance, but new research indicates they may offer some protection from a virus that's much more dangerous. For VOA, Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
It's a question that has puzzled scientists. Why are some people able to resist coronavirus infection despite prolonged exposure? So researchers at Imperial College of London set out to test a theory that a type of white blood cells called T cells produced by the human body to fight the common cold could offer some protection. Report co-author Professor Ajit Lalwani.
Previous infection with common cold coronaviruses, so these are distantly related cousins of SARS-CoV-2, which causes COVID, so that such endemic common cold-causing coronaviruses, that infection with those might induce T cells that would be able to cross-recognize and then attack the SARS-CoV-2 virus. And so that was the theory we set about to test.
The study began in September 2020, before any mass vaccination programs and before most people had been infected with COVID. Scientists tested the blood of 52 people who lived in the same household as someone infected with the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID. Half of those sampled contracted COVID, while half did not.
And what we found was that those contacts who had pre-existing T cells that were induced by common cold coronavirus but cross-recognize and attack SARS-CoV-2, people with such T cells didn't get infected.
Current vaccines are designed to trigger an immune response that targets the spike proteins on the outside of the coronavirus that are able to mutate and escape immunity.
In contrast, the T cells we discovered that mediate this protection are directed against proteins in the core of the virus, internal proteins, and these proteins are much less changeable. So essentially, our findings provide the blueprint for developing a universal T cell inducing vaccine to protect people against current and all future variants of COVID.
An exciting prospect, but development of such a vaccine remains some way off. Meanwhile, the report authors emphasize that no one should rely on a common cold infection to provide immunity against COVID and say vaccination offers the best protection. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Doctors at the University of Maryland Medical Center recently performed a historic heart transplant. For the first time, a genetically modified pig's heart was successfully transplanted into a 57-year-old patient who was suffering from end-stage heart disease. The medical center reports that the patient, identified as David Bennett of Maryland, is doing well days after the operation. They say the patient will continue to be carefully monitored in the days and weeks ahead. A press release from the University of Maryland says that since doctors found the patient was ineligible for a conventional human heart transplant, using a pig's heart was the only available option. Mr. Bennett said in the press release, quote, "It was either die or do this transplant. I want to live," unquote. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
That's all the time we have for you today. On behalf of managing editor Kate Dawson, producer Nadia Taha, and the entire production team, thank you so much for joining us on VOA's International Edition. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington.
Kim Lewis. Join me and a panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including Americans are increasingly frustrated over long lines to get tested for COVID-19 and a shortage of testing kits for use at home. We'll have this topic and more on Issues in the News.